Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining Liberating the Queen, a podcast where we discuss amazing women in history that weren't in my history books. My goal for 2018 is to share what I have learned with all of you the 15th of every month. I am Susie Mosco, and today is June 15th, 2018. This episode is brought to you by Radio Tower Digital. Change is good, adaptability is better, helping leaders solve digital strategy needs since 2013. Today, in this episode, we are talking about two amazing women who are the first of their gender and/or their ethnicity to receive a PhD. We have many special guests this week on the podcast. Go ahead, girls, introduce yourself.
My name's Mila.
Hi, my name's Malika. I'm 7 years old, and my birthday is on January.
Hi, my name is Layla, and I was in the last podcast.
Welcome, everyone. Are you guys excited to be here?
Yeah.
Now, let me ask you guys a couple questions. Does any one of you want to be a doctor?
No.
I don't know what to say. It's just...
Maybe.
Malika, do you have a boy doctor or a girl doctor?
I think I have a girl doctor.
Okay. I have a girl doctor.
You both have girl doctors?
Yep.
In this podcast, we're going to talk about how some of the first, or really just talk about some of the first women who became doctors. There was a time in history when only boys were allowed to be doctors. Could you guys imagine having a boy as a doctor?
No.
We have two amazing women we are going to talk about today. First is Fi del Mundo. Dr. Fi is credited with studies that lead to the invention of an improved incubator and a jaundice-relieving device. She dedicated her life to the cause of pediatrics in the Philippines. Her pioneering work in pediatrics in the Philippines is an active medical practice that really spanned about 8 decades. The second woman we're going to talk about is Susan LaFish Pacotti, the first Native American woman to become a doctor in the United States. She was born in 1865 and grew up on the Omaha Reservation. She left in 1884 to attend the Hampton Institute in Virginia and later earned a medical degree at the Women's College of Pennsylvania. She returned to the reservation and worked as a physician there until 1894, working in a private practice. She treated tribal people and white people, advocating for better health care overall. In 1913, she founded a reservation hospital, which was later named in her honor. Susan died in 1915, but left a strong legacy across Native American culture and how they treat patients today. Join us as we cut into the medical profession.
He was born in Manila, the capital of the Philippines. When she was growing up, very few people in the country had access to a doctor to care for their children.
So because Fi grew up in an area where there was really a lack of doctors to care for siblings, 3 of Fi's 8 siblings died in infancy. And when her older sister became sick with appendicitis at age 11, there was nothing her family could do to save her life. After these tragic experiences, Fi decided that she would dedicate her life to filling this need for access to quality medical care for children in the Philippines.
At age 15, Fi went to college and received her associate's and medical degree from the University of the Philippines in Manila.
Thanks to her valedictorian status and her exceptional performance on the medical board exam, the president of the Philippines at the time offered Fee a full scholarship to any school in the United States. She accepted and picked Harvard. Now, during this time, Harvard was debating its stance to allow female entrance. Fee's application came across their desk, and due to an oversight, officials didn't realize Fee's gender and unwittingly enrolled her as the first female student. The mistake wasn't realized until Fee arrived in Boston. In 1936, she found she was assigned to an all-male dorm. Her record was so strong, however, the head of pediatrics claimed there was no reason to turn her away since she'd already been admitted. Fee then had become the first female student at Harvard Medical School and the only woman to be enrolled at that time. According to her biography, quote, Fee humorously relates that when she arrived in Boston and went to the dormitory assigned to her in a letter from the director of the hospital housing, much to her surprise, she found herself in a men's dorm. Unknowingly, the Harvard officials had admitted a female to their all-male student body. Because her record was so strong, the head of the pediatrics department saw no reason not to accept her, thus upsetting Harvard tradition. She became the first Filipino woman and the only female at the time to be enrolled in Harvard Medical School. The head of pediatrics at Harvard was so impressed with her qualifications that he advocated and championed her to stay and throughout her career there. Fee worked twice as hard and became a force at Harvard, even though she barely stood 5 feet tall. After her education at Harvard, Fee would go on to study at the University of Chicago and MIT. She would earn her master's degree in bacteriology at the Boston School of Medicine before finally returning to the Philippines in 1941. Shortly before the Japanese invasion of the Philippines during World War II. During the war, the Japanese placed thousands of Filipinos, including children, into internment camps, much like the prison camps that plagued Europe at the time. Fee began working with the International Red Cross and set up a hospice at the University of Santo Tomas, where many sick children were being detained. She would go on to treat everyone she could. It turned out to be more than over 100 children. And for her efforts, she became known as the Angel of Santo Tomas. After the Japanese shut down her hospice in 1943, the mayor of Manila asked her to set up a government hospital. She became director of the new medical center, but soon became frustrated with the constraints of working for the government and left to start a private hospital. Now, Mila, it's really expensive to start a hospital. What do you think she had to sell to start a hospital? What do you think? Do you think if she had a house, she would have to sell her house?
Yes.
What if she had a car? Do you think she'd have to sell her car?
Yes.
How much do you think it costs to start a hospital?
$9 million.
$9 million. That's very close and very accurate. Fee did. She sold her own home and everything she owned to pay for the new hospital. In 1957, the Children's Medical Center was the first pediatric hospital to ever be established in the Philippines, and it opened its doors. After selling her home and selling basically everything, Fee would live on the second floor of the hospital and would work around the clock to do the greatest amount of good she could. While Fee continued to practice pediatrics at the Children's Medical Center, she also continued to research into infectious disease. Undaunted by the lack of modern laboratory facilities in the Philippines, she often shipped samples abroad for analysis. In her lifetime, she published over 100 articles, reviews, and reports in medical journals. Her research into dengue fever especially contributed to a greater understanding of how the disease works and affects children. Fee also wrote the Textbook of Pediatrics, which was also used in medical schools in the Philippines for many years. Throughout her career, she was active in promoting public health with an emphasis on rural mothers and their children. Her work also helped to facilitate and improve the coordination between hospitals, doctors, and midwives. In 1966, Fee received the Elizabeth Blackwell Award for Outstanding Service to Mankind. In 1977, Fee received the Ramon Magsaway Award for Outstanding Public Service. She also received the 15th International Congress of Pediatrics Award as the Most Outstanding Pediatrician and Humanitarian in 1977. She lived in the hospital for the rest of her life and was still making rounds to check on patients when she was wheelchair-bound at the age of 99. She passed away from a heart attack just a few months before her 100th birthday in 2001. So, girls, can you guys tell me what part of Fee's life were you most surprised by?
That she had to sell her house and her car and everything she owned just to buy a hospital.
Malaika, do you think that the amount of people she helped, she lived in the hospital so she could help more people. How many people do you think she helped? How many kids do you think she helped?
20,000.
20,000. That's a lot of kids. Do you think that if given the chance, you would move into a hospital and help kids, Mila?
No.
No. Not at all? You're still not interested in being a doctor?
Because it would be a lot of money. That's why I think she doesn't want to be.
But you're happy that you have female doctors and not boy doctors, right?
Yes, because Layla, I don't know why Layla wants to be.
Layla wants to be a doctor?
No, she doesn't want to be a doctor. I know why she doesn't want a boy doctor.
Got it.
I would not want to live inside a hospital.
Right.
Because you'd have to sleep in the beds that the other people would. And I just don't want to do that because you could get sick if somebody that was sick in there and it could get infected.
Right.
And all the beds are all germy, so she could get sick.
Or she could have an amazing immune system because her body would have built up so many immunities.
That makes sense. Right. Yeah.
For our next segment, we will be talking about Susan LaFlesche. She was born on the Omaha Indian Reservation in northeast Nebraska on June 17, 1865. She was the youngest of four daughters of Chief Joseph LaFlesche, otherwise known as Iron Eyes, of the Omaha tribe, and his wife, Mary Gail, known as One Woman. Both parents were of mixed race and wanted their children to live in the white and the Native American worlds.
In 1837, Chief Big Elk returned to the Omaha people from his trip to Washington with a warning.
Quote, "There is a coming flood which will soon reach us, and I advise you to prepare for it," end quote. He told them. In Washington, he had never really seen the future and wanted to ensure his people were prepared for it. The universe was at odds with the traditions of the Omaha, and he wanted to encourage his people to adapt. Before his death in 1853, he chose a man with a similar vision to succeed him as chief of the Omaha tribe, a man of French and Indian descent named Joseph LaFlesche, Susan's father. Joseph was the type of chief who really wanted to push for that balanced existence, one that would allow for more cultural integration as he feared that the Omahas and the Native American as a culture were beginning to vanish. Soon, the Omaha really splintered between the, quote, young men's party, end quote, open to the incorporation of white customs, and, quote, chief's party, end quote, a group loyal to traditional medicine men who really wouldn't budge. When the young men's party started to build log cabins rather than teepees, and they started laying out roads and farming on individual parcels, the conservatives nicknamed the north side of the reservation, quote, the village of the make-believe white people, end quote. It was here in one of these log cabins that Susan shared with her three older sisters. She really grew up not only in fear of her vanishing people, but really wanting to make sure she was incorporating her heritage and integrating it into the new society, and really ensure her thoughts and her people could evolve in that way as well. Sometime later, she met a Harvard anthropologist named Allison Cunningham Fletcher. She was a woman's right advocate who would shepherd her to the East and up the long and often prejudiced ladder of formal education. After attending a school on the reservation, young Susan attended the Elizabeth Institute for Young Ladies and later the Hampton Institute in Virginia, from which she graduated in 1886. While growing up on the Omaha Reservation, several experiences really led Susan to consider and really yearn for a medical education. She had experienced the poor living conditions of the Omaha people, and when she was 8 years old, she stayed at the bedside of an elderly woman who was in agonizing pain. She waited for the white doctor to arrive. Four times a messenger was sent, and four times the doctor said he'd be there soon. Not long before the sunrise, the woman died, and the doctor never came. Susan knew she had to do something to change this predicament for her people. And again, she just continued to be plagued by the fear of vanishing people and how she could help her people really evolve. When at the Hampton Institute, Susan was encouraged by one of her mentors, Martha Waldron, to acquire a scholarship from the U.S. Office of Indian Affairs. When that scholarship was granted, she became the first person to receive federal aid for a professional education. In 1886, she began to attend the Women's Medical College of Pennsylvania. Only a few medical schools at the time accepted women. Now, Mila, Susan was a pretty smart and pretty ambitious girl, right?
Yes.
Yes. Do you think when she was in medical school, do you think she graduated at the bottom of her class, in the middle of the class? How smart do you think Susan was?
Very smart.
Very smart. Susan graduated second in her class. Now, be mindful, at that time, they didn't want women to be doctors. There was all boy doctors. Would you want Susan to be your doctor if she was that smart?
Yes.
Yes. Thank you, Mila. From the Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute in Virginia, now Hampton University, Susan graduated second in her class. She was fluent in English and her native tongue. She could speak French. She quoted scripture from Shakespeare. She spent her free time learning to paint and play the piano. She was really driven by her father's warning to his young daughters. Do you always want to simply be called those Indians? Or do you want to go to school and be somebody in the world? While pursuing her education, Susan continued to experience life in both the white and Native American worlds. While in school, she was in awe of the lavish dresses she saw in department stores. When she was fitted for a dress, she wrote to one of her sisters that it made her want to become a lady of fashion. In the same letter, she told her sisters that she yearned for a pair of moccasins.
She knew if she graduated, Susan would become the country's first Native American doctor.
Quote, "We who are educated have to be pioneers of Indian civilization," end quote. She did an interview for the East Coast during her Hampton graduation speech. Quote, "The white people have reached a high standard of civilization, but how many years has it taken them? We are only beginning, so do not try to put us down, but help us climb higher. Give us a chance," end quote. 3 years later, Susan became a doctor. She graduated as valedictorian of her class and could suture wounds, deliver babies, and treat tuberculosis. But as a woman, she could not vote, and as an Indian, she could not call herself a citizen under American law. None of the challenges of her education could fully prepare Susan for what she encountered upon her return to the reservation as a physician. Soon after she opened the doors to her new office in the government boarding school, the tribe began to file in. Many of them were sick with tuberculosis or cholera, others simply looking for a clean place to rest. She became their doctor. But in many ways, she was their lawyer, their accountant, their priest, and their political liaison. So many of the sick insisted on Dr. Susan, as they called her, that her white counterpart quit, making her the only physician on the reservation. And this wasn't a small reservation. It spanned about 1,500 square miles.
She dreamed of one day building a hospital for her tribe.
But for now, she made house calls, again, on this 15,000 square mile reservation. She was walking through winds and snow on horseback and later in a buggy, traveling for hours to reach even a single patient. But even after risking her own life to reach distant patients, she would often encounter the Omahas who rejected her diagnosis and question everything she learned in a school so far away. In 1894, Susan married Henry Pacote, a Sioux Indian from South Dakota. The couple moved to Bancroft, Nebraska, where she set up a private practice and they raised two children. In a time of Victorian values, when women were generally expected to be full-time mothers and housekeepers after they married, Dr. Susan worked as a full-time professional. For most of his adult life, Henry suffered from alcoholism, and often Susan had to take care of him while simultaneously running her medical practice. When Henry died in 1905, Susan became determined to eliminate the alcohol on the reservation. In 1906, she led a delegation to Washington, D.C. to lobby for the prohibition of alcohol on Indian lands. Her opposition to alcohol on the reservation led to fight for other causes and to attract some controversy. She supported a new Native American religious movement, the Peyote religion, a pro-temperance Christian denomination that sought to introduce the hallucinogenic drug peyote into Native American spiritual traditions. This put her in opposition with many of her white medical colleagues. She also became an activist for the tribal people's legal status and citizenship and fought against land fraud perpetrated on the Omaha people. Her activism hit home when she confronted the Bureau of Indian Affairs bureaucracy to prove she was more competent than a male relative to oversee her husband's estate after his death from alcoholism. Later in life, Susan opened a private practice in nearby Bancroft, Nebraska, treating whites and Indians alike. She persuaded the Office of Indian Affairs to ban liquor sales in towns formed within the reservation boundaries. Susan also pushed for modern hygiene and disease prevention standards among the Omaha people. In 1913, she fulfilled a lifelong dream by opening a hospital on the Omaha reservation town of Walt Hill, Nebraska. Despite these accomplishments, Susan suffered from chronic pain and respiratory problems. And as she grew older, her health declined, and she became unable to carry on her many causes. Susan passed away from bone cancer in 1915. Susan's legacy extends beyond being the first Native American female physician. She championed many causes of Native Americans in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and she is considered to be an early trailblazer of the women's movement. Susan was ahead of her time in pursuing causes many considered unimportant. She never shied away from speaking truth to power, even when it meant facing criticism from both white and tribal people. She was also one of the first to not only encourage the practice of proper hygiene, but lobbied the government for better funding and management of the Native American population. She put rhetoric into practice by founding a medical association to set and enforce health standards on the reservation. She took her cause to Washington, D.C., advocating for better laws to help the Native American people. And she started her own hospital to better serve the people she cared for so deeply. Her courage and compassion made her a unique and effective leader. She stayed true and stayed driven and really protected her culture in a way that we don't see very often today, in not necessarily dismaying traditions, but really trying to embrace an evolution to ensure that the Omaha people, her people, had longevity throughout decades to come. So, girls, Dr. Susan was our second story. Mila, what was one of your favorite parts in learning about Dr. Susan?
That she was a doctor.
That she was a doctor. And you love her.
My favorite part was when she decided to help all the Native Americans and start a hospital.
I'm glad I learned that she, even though that women couldn't be doctors, I'm glad she still did it.
I'm too. Did you see, Malaika, did you see similarities in the stories between the first one with Fee and the second one with Susan?
Yeah.
What were some of the things that were the same?
They both decided to be doctors.
They did. They both came from like rural communities. They were poor and they wanted to become doctors because they saw that children weren't being treated and children were dying and they wanted to help. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Susan didn't have to sell everything to get a hospital, though. That was nice, right?
Another similarity of them, they both decided to make their own hospital.
Yeah, that's pretty big deal. Would you make your own hospital if you could?
I love them. No,
probably
I wouldn't.
Not.
Probably not?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't want a Malaika Isabella O'Brien hospital?
Nope.
No? What if it treated like pets?
What are you talking about?
What if they treated like animals? What if you were an animal doctor?
I would like that.
I would love that.
Yeah?
So much. I would like that a little bit, but, like, if I, like, I would have to, like, there's, like, a lot of animals with fur, and they could shed it around, mm-hmm. and then it will be a pretty dirty. So I would have to sweep all the time. And
right. That's a lot of sweeping. That's a lot of sweeping. Well, but thanks, girls, for joining us. Can you all say thank you?
Thank you.
We want to thank everyone for joining Liberating the Queen. If you have any thoughts or feedback on the podcast, please reach out to us via email at contact@liberatingthequeen.com. Again, this episode is brought to you by Radio Tower Digital. change is good, adaptability is better, helping leaders solve digital strategy needs since 2013. We look forward to talking with everyone again on July 15th, 2018.